Bitch, you better have my money. Bitch, you better have my money.
Oh, shit.
Bitch, bitch, you better have my money.
Wow, this is
so dramatic.
Yeah, it's extremely. This music is extremely dramatic. It is extremely dramatic.
Thank you, Dave.
And thank you, Dave, for producing us. And your dance moves are rather dramatic as well.
Hey, folks.
Hey, welcome back.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, Em.
Welcome back.
To Unapologetic.
A Black Love Manifesto.
Yes.
That music had me crunk, Shawty.
Yes.
So what are we talking about today?
Today, we're going to be talking about wealth. Black women and wealth.
All righty then.
How do we get it? What are the barriers to not getting it?
Love it. All the good stuff with black women, money, get you some, don't have none, the whole nine, right?
The whole nine.
All right, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
And I live an unapologetic life.
Living authentically with yourself and unapologetic.
Faith in humanity. Unapologetic. Unapologetic.
What up, though?
Welcome back.
Welcome back.
To Unapologetic.
The Black Love Manifesto. I'm Eb.
I'm Jay.
And today we are talking about black women and wealth.
Yes.
But before we get into all of that, how are you?
You know, I'm good.
Okay.
It's Yes, I'm good. I'm good, amazingly. Yeah, right?
Yes.
I am. My disposition always changes when it's like nice outside.
Oh.
So as long as it's nice.
You good, money.
We're winning.
Okay.
We're winning,
I need to remember this. We're going to have to bring some sunshine to the resistance.
Always. Plus, I just feel, I'm wearing skirts. There's sunshine.
Yeah, you look really cute. I like this dress.
Thanks.
Yeah.
It's this oldie but a goodie. I'm happy.
Very cool.
Happy, cool. Healthy,
good.
Energized. How are you?
You've been getting sleep, huh?
Not that much. Not enough. Not enough.
Okay.
Unfortunately, not enough. Okay. But, I'm keeping on. How about you?
I can't.
You look lovely, as
you.
Always. But, you also look lovely.
I feel like having my boobs out today.
I see that.
Yeah.
I was like, look at them. They're like, pow, pow.
Pop that.
Yeah.
So. I'm supposed to be hooking up with one of my homies today after work.
Nice.
Do a little Mocha Moms outing. So, hey, shout out to the Mocha Moms.
Mocha Moms, yes.
And I'm feeling okay. I have been going through, as you know, quite a bit of overwhelm lately.
Yes.
But I feel like it is finally subsiding.
Why?
Because I thought it was like on a cycle. Like I thought it was going crazy.
That's what you said last time or two times ago or something like that.
One of the cycles has ended. And so new things are, it's like freeing up space for new things to happen.
Mm.
And I, for the first time in a long time, I found myself like, I could take a small break right here.
Oh, that's nice. Good. That's really nice.
It was really nice.
So it's like family, work, friends.
Yeah.
All of it.
Some of the things are still, ongoing.
Percolating.
In terms of some of the workload, I think has been lightened. So I'm closing out some projects. I can see the end goal. I'm very happy about that.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Really good. Yeah.
Rocking stuff off. Yes.
Yes, you are a mammoth list maker.
Yes.
That's true. And,
and
when you make the list, how many things get crossed off normally? Like all of them?
In a day. I mean, because on average, my lists are looking like at least 6 to 10 things in a day.
Yeah.
So if I can get through at least 3 of major ones, then I'm happy.
Yes. Oh, that's good.
Yeah. That's pretty good.
I feel like that's me. My calendar used to be like 10 things a day.
Yeah.
And then I realized really only like 2 to 3 were getting done.
You know,
so
fairly true.
You just
keep the others like kind of in perspective.
They just hover right
here.
Yeah.
Like, you know what else I want to keep in perspective,
what?
Right? My money.
Yes.
I need to keep them coins.
In perspective.
In perspective.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
So I always think about, when I learned a long time ago, wealth is what you own minus what you owe.
Mm.
Right? Like, so you take up all of
what
your...
What you own
Yeah.
Minus what you owe. So like
your debts.
Income minus expenses.
Well, assets.
Oh, asset minus expenses. Yeah. Okay. Got you.
And then, you know, then that's your net wealth. I'm not an economist, but that's what United for a Fair Economy calls wealth, right?
Okay.
What do you think? Like, so I don't think most people think of that as wealth.
I don't think so. Because you heard the first thing I said, right? I said your income minus your expenses.
Because like income and wealth is different. Yeah,
it is. Yeah. It is. When you say it in that regard of an asset, because, you know, you might have some things put away or some things that are worth value.
Right.
And then, but you're not like maximizing everything out of it.
The benefit. Yeah. Also, most Americans are really kind of living in negative wealth, right? Because we're mostly debt. Yeah. We're a debtor nation. We're mostly living in debt. So most people don't have wealth.
Yeah. The first thing came to my mind was, you know, both you and I recently became homeowners.
Yes.
And so first thing came to my mind, I was like, well, that's massive debt.
That doesn't
feel like an asset at all.
Right. It is.
But they tell you that home ownership is like the key to wealth. Right?
Yeah.
I wonder how much of that is like a fallacy in this day and age.
Well, I think it depends, right? Also, you know, home ownership. Like, were you really excited? Like, you always had a dream of owning a home. Was that a thing for you?
No.
Yeah, me neither.
No.
Me neither.
To be honest with you, I distinctly remember being in my early 20s.
Yeah.
And Jade's father actually was trying to get me to invest in a home. And I was like, no, son. I was like, that's a lot of work.
Well, you're thinking like to pay for it or the upkeep?
I was thinking both. Okay. And my mind at that time was just like, I was like, first, I'm not trying to clean no big old house like that.
Right.
I was like, and on top of that, I just like, it was like a sense of dread came over me about the payments.
Right.
But in hindsight, I think actually to have done it way back then.
Yeah.
And then to be here now probably would have been smarter.
Because you would have equity.
By now.
Right.
All the market stuff would have happened. It was before, like, it was years before the market fallout.
Yes, because we're very seasoned and grown up in here.
You know, grown. Grown. Extra grown. I'm so happy to be so extra grown, girl. Girl.
Indeed. Grown ladies. Grown ladies. Yeah. Yeah, it was never my dream either. I was really perfectly happy to be a renter kind of forever. I was like, oh, it should be fine. And then, you know, I was living in New York and the rental market was so crazy. Like every year it was like
increasing,
crazy increases. See, and landlords were doing,
like, what was it that made you
everything to just not just like, you know, maybe $50, maybe $100, but like $200-$300.
Oh, no.
Right. Every fucking year. And
what happened to
rent control. Most places are not rent controlled in New York. They're rent stabilized, right? Which means that they can't raise it above a certain amount. But then the landlords were pulling all these tactics to actually ensure that it increased like a significant amount every year. And that was really the only thing that I thought, okay, well, a mortgage, relatively speaking, is going to be stable, way more stable than rent.
Right.
So that was kind of, that was like literally the only reason I did it.
That would be the benefit. Because if you get a good place in New York, you definitely don't, like, people don't really try to just get up and move.
No, you want to lock that down.
My aunt has been in her apartment for like 30 years.
And if you can do that,
but
now most apartments, it's not sustainable to be in there for 30, 40 years because, you know, the landlords are doing a lot of like heinous tactics.
You should have saw the post I put on social media. It was like a little apartment this size and like somebody literally had it in their hand and they're like, this is a New York loft apartment. It's $17 billion and it's only 200 square feet.
Right. So no, that's so real. It's so real. Right. So then I really started thinking, okay, now I really need to buy a place mostly for stability, right? Mm-hmm. Monthly, yearly stability. But then I started researching what it means to like actually have wealth and realizing that like home ownership was kind of in the US like the main way most people acquire wealth
here.
Yeah, in the US. Mm-hmm. In the US.
Do you feel like in your family you had a lot of examples of people doing like acquiring wealth easily or setting, you know?
No, and I don't think that's something, I mean, just, you know, sort of like thinking historically, that's not like black people have had like wealth divested, right, from our communities, but also then, of course, individually. So I never really, like, when my parents bought a home, that was like a big deal.
Yeah.
A big deal. And they had to put all their pennies together to be able to do it, yeah, right? And I remember my dad, this is like year later on, my dad saying, like, well, we weren't even going to get a prime mortgage. We were going to have to take, we weren't going to take a mortgage because they didn't want to give it to us because, like, we didn't have enough. We just didn't have enough down. And he had, there was some like special like pension program that like kind of gave it, like showed that they had more income. Mm-hmm. And that was like kind of the only thing that got them over the edge to be able to qualify for the mortgage. And this was like, you know, early 90s. So,
I wonder if, like, you think any redlining was involved in that, or?
For sure. I mean, we were buying my, well, we, I still see how, see how I say like they, because I contributed nothing.
Hey, mom and pop.
Hey, mommy and daddy. They were buying in a black community, a community, well, that had at one point been like Italian, mm-hmm. but then like quickly turned over to be black in like the 60s and 70s. And so I'm sure there was redlining happening, mm-hmm. in that community. As in most black communities, right? Mm-hmm. Redlining just was something that was prolific, right? Yeah. It was everywhere in all black communities. And we weren't getting, you know, prime mortgages, all that stuff. All of that is kind of part and parcel of why black people being, like, acquiring wealth is so difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, it is difficult. It's interesting, too, because I'm thinking about family. I'm thinking about the impressions that you have as a child about wealth and what you know.
Yeah. What impressions did you have?
Well, it's interesting because, like, my aunt who passed away about 3 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, she was the first homeowner that I can of in our family. Everybody
what
used to
year
gather,
was that? Do you
gather
remember?
There. What? Oh, when she had a home?
Yeah, she
bought
a home.
Oh, it was many moons ago because it was when she lived here in Queens, and then she ended up moving down to Atlanta in the late 80s, early 90s, something like that. So it was, you know, but she was like so wealthy in my eyes.
Because
like
she owned a home?
She owned a home. Yeah. I could go in her closet and like get in her shoes and, you know, all her makeup.
All
and
the I things. Just, all
auntie,
the things.
And she used to do the big Christmas at her house. Yeah, I used to be out of my mind as a kid. Like, that was what it was. It was so funny thinking about how kids or, you know, like how you look at your family and think about, well, the other day I go to the grocery store. True story. And I don't have no shame in my game.
Right? Yeah. Tell it.
So go to the grocery store. And I literally ran out the house with one card. One credit card? It wasn't even a credit card. It was like my debit card from like a petty cash account.
Oh, yeah.
I usually would take my bag, you know, multiple cards, whatever I need, my ID. I didn't have my ID. I had nothing but this one card. I had no clue what the balance was or anything on the account. I get in the grocery store. I'm thinking I'm just going to do a quick shop, whatever.
Right,
just grab a couple things. I didn't even think I would spend $50.
Yeah.
Get to the cash register. The bill is like $150.
Okay? Oh, wow. Yeah. So, that's always the way.
That's always the way. So Justin is with me. My son Justin is with me. And so we're scanning everything. So I see the total and I'm like, oh shit. I was like, I don't know what's on this card, but we gonna see today, right?
Yeah.
So I swipe the card. It looks like it goes through.
Yes.
Well, lo and behold, the guy is like, oh yeah, it took the whole thing except for like, I don't know, $20 or something. I'm like, shit. So it's not like I could run to the car and be like, oh, let me just go get out of the bag or something. So I'm like, all right, well, I quickly grab a couple things because you know how it is. You in the grocery store, you're buying a whole bunch of shit you didn't need anyway. I literally went there for like $50 of stuff. I don't know how I got up to $150.
Right.
So how come when we get ready to leave out the store, Justin is like, oh my God, that was so intense.
Why was that intense for him?
I was like, now mind you, this is my 13-year-old son. Yeah. And he's like, oh my God, that was so intense.
Yeah.
I'm like, Justin, what was so intense about that?
Yeah.
He was like, well, I've never seen that before. Like, I've seen that on TV.
But you couldn't afford your groceries?
Yeah, he was like, Ma, you couldn't afford the groceries. Wow. I was like, bendito. I was like, you never seen the struggle? I was like, look at your little show. He was like, Ma, you're the richest person I know.
Oh, wow.
I was like, wow. Such a disservice, right?
Well, to him, maybe, right? Like, not, I mean, I don't want your children to go hungry, obviously,
you know?
But also, like, not knowing that you there are people who can't afford groceries, and maybe you're one of them.
Right.
Maybe, you know, they're one. They, maybe they're in a family that might not be able to afford groceries. Yeah.
Because times get hard all the time, but it made me think about how he's so sheltered from it.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a perception of we're going through it or whatever. And I was just like, wow.
Okay. And I do think a lot of people, you know, it's funny because even though, like, most people's lived experience is struggling, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not getting paid enough, is not having wealth. In fact, is having, like, a lot of debt. That's most Americans, right?
Yeah.
But there's this illusion, I feel like, that, well, that's somebody else.
Right.
You know, that's not us-ins. That's, like, you know, that's those people over there who can't make it happen, who are on whatever, you know, public assistance. Yeah. When in reality, that's us. That's,
I will take somebody food stamps so quick. Bring me them food stamps.
That's us. Yeah.
Well, you know what, folks? Today, we were supposed to have a special guest. In the studio with us, Ann Price. And we had a little bit of technical difficulty.
So maybe we're not going to have her today.
Well, we don't know. We don't know.
We're on the edge of our seat. And if you are listening, you should call in.
Call in right now. So we're going to take a quick break.
Yes.
And we'll be back to talk to y'all a little bit more about Black women and wealth.
What up?
Welcome back to Unapologetic,
a Black Love Manifesto.
I'm Jay. And today we are talking about Black women and wealth. And guess what, folks? We have our special guest, Ann Price, on the line.
Yay. Ann, can you hear us?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
It's great to be here.
Woohoo. I'm sorry for our technical difficulties.
Yes. We were trying to get you on earlier, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Sorry about that.
No.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. And you can hear us loud and clear.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Awesome.
Perfect.
Were you listening, or were you able to hear any of what me and Eb were chatting about earlier?
No. I've been having some connectivity issues, was furiously trying to figure out what's happening with our IT person.
Thank you for trying to figure that out and figuring it out. So that's awesome. So Eb and I were talking all about sort of wealth and how we've sort of understood it in our growing up, in our childhoods, and how we define it. But I want to just, I'm so horrible with titles, but I want to tell everyone who's listening that you, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you lead the Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative at the Insight Center for Community Economic Development. Is that right or crazy?
That's correct.
Yay!
Nice.
Awesome. So I just want to hear from you, like, how did you get into the work that you're doing? Like, how did you come to even sort of have this as a focus of your life and your work? Well, I don't know if it's focus of your life, but your work certainly.
Yeah, I mean, I have really been focused on the issue of poverty for so many years. Mm. And I've worked on so many different kinds of issues, from higher ed to hunger. I worked on kind of foster care and welfare reform and a whole host of issues. And it's only through wealth have I really understood what it takes for people to really have true opportunity in their life, you know, to have peace of mind that, you know, you can weather a storm or live out a dream, you know, to have some kind of seed capital that you can start a business and, you know, really kind of move to that next level. It's really through wealth and that income, which I had been so focused on, that you're able to do that. And so, Black people specifically.
Yeah. So can you give us, like, because I gave my little, like, you know, two cent definition of wealth.
Yeah.
So can you give us the distinction? Because I think when we think about it, like, what's the distinction between wealth and income?
Definition is basically wealth is everything you own in the world. Minus everything you owe, all your debt.
You were right.
And I was right.
When you subtract that, that's the wealth that you own.
Awesome.
It's that simple.
Awesome. Okay. Perfect. Okay. Right. So I was on point with that. Probably because I read something that you wrote. Yeah. Yeah. And so what do you think are the biggest like barriers to Black people building wealth? Because I think when we think about wealth, we might think about Oprah, we might think about Jay-Z, Beyonce, who we were just listening to. So like, you know, what is wealth? Like, how do we acquire it? What are the barriers to it for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably the biggest misnomer that's out there, and it's really hard for people to kind of grapple with this, is that wealth is something that can be easily attained, right? Mm-hmm. And it's so often confused with income, right? People with extremely high income.
Yeah, that's what I said.
But wealth is really that store, a store of resources. And it's, you know, when we look at the wealth in which Black people hold, and we know that we have a rich history and that, you know, we have basically built a lot of the wealth that exists in this country today. It came off of us from slavery as if our bodies have been used to generate wealth for others. But it's not been, we haven't been able to generate that for ourselves. And so really at the crux of this is really, there's a, is really white advantage and racism. And when we look at our history and historical policies, we really see a country in which wealth has been extracted from some people so that others can gain wealth. And whether it was taking native land and doing that, it was, you know, a lot of the land that we owned as farmers has been taken and basically given to other folks. But that's the way in which, you know, we've seen wealth kind of, you know, kind of fall out of our hands.
Right.
And so these things about kind of building Black wealth, I'm not saying that there's not important steps, but when you're looking at differences in wealth between Black people and whites being so extreme, it's not like $30,000 or $50,000. You're talking about sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars, that it really is rooted in this, in racism, you know, and white advantage.
So
what what do we do then? Like, can you tell us more about the work that you're doing to bridge the wealth gap?
Right. So one of the things that we think is really important is for, let's just understand not just like what wealth is, but also kind of like the dynamic nature of it. So, for example, we were really looking at this issue of education because we believe, and it's not like it's a crazy belief, that if you go and get an education, you go to college, that you will have, you know, be able to kind of build wealth more readily. And while that is the case with whites, it's not the case necessarily with Black people, and particularly Black women. And so we have to then dig down to say, well, what's holding us back? What is keeping us from being able to do this? And I think there's a number of factors that are. We think about issues like, for example, segregation and how that plays out today. It determines where we can buy a home, how much that home is worth, and, you know, kind of how much we can build wealth in that way.
Right.
If we think about, you know, issues of mass incarceration and the kinds of fees and fines that are being extolled on us from a number, even from municipal fines and fees to traffic fines and fees to a whole host of fines and fees.
Have mercy, the fees.
That's also extracting resources. You know, you think about Black women, they're oftentimes supporting families and more than just their immediate family. You know, they're supporting parents. They're supporting siblings. They are, you know, sometimes giving up their wealth for others. So I think that's some of the things that are kind of keeping us from being able to be where we want to be.
So that's a really good point. I'm wondering, are there, looking specifically at Black women's wealth, you know, is it true that... Black women, or isn't it true? what is true? What is true, I guess, about Black women's ability to acquire wealth? Like, you know, so we, particularly because, you know, the stat says that, you know, Black women have the most advanced degrees of any other group in the country, right? So, like, you know, like, if that's the case, then, you know, as you were saying, like, so if we've got all these advanced degrees, then, like, shouldn't that be translating into wealth, or at least income that translates into wealth?
Well, unfortunately, it's not translating in the way that we anticipated that a college degree particularly would do.
Right.
Like, for example, if you look at black women under 30 with a bachelor's degree, they're in debt about to the tune of about $11,000. And right. they have really, like, when we look at kind of all women, this group of women had the lowest wealth holding. Black right. women under 30 with a degree. Mm. And then you look at black women like 30 to 39 with a degree who are single. I'm talking about single black women. Mm. They have a wealth of zero, right? Meaning half people have like zero or below are in debt and half have higher than that. Mm. So something is not happening. It's not translating in the same way, for example, that we would see, you know, this happen with white women. Mm. And so that's troubling. And we have to dig down to say, you know, what, you know, we know that some of what's behind this is student loan debt.
Yeah.
Right. We also know that a lot of blacks coming out of college tend to have higher unemployment rates.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Some levels are quite troubling. We also know that even when we work, our incomes are less
right.
for the same type of jobs,
right.
even in STEM fields, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
there are a myriad of factors there that are at play that are driving this. And then in addition to the fact that basically when you think about how people get wealth, wealth begets wealth.
Yeah.
So,
right.
you know, if you're starting off and you go to college and you don't really, you know, you're scraping by, you know, and have to basically finance it yourself, you know, you're coming out without much to hold on to. You know, think about even like going out after getting a degree and trying to put a down payment on an apartment.
Right.
I'm here in the Bay Area, California.
Right.
You need about $5,000 to put down yeah. on a one bedroom apartment.
Yeah, similar to New York. Yeah.
yeah.
That's wealth, right?
That's wealth.
So basically, I think that's some of the reason why, you know, there's kind of a slower start after graduation and getting a degree, and then it's just harder and harder to kind of build that over time, you know. So it's even when we do have some wealth, it's just not a store of wealth that can help transform our lives, right?
Right, yeah.
You know, to
right.
transform them. It might help us weather, like, a broken, you know, furnace, right?
Right,
or something
right.
like
not
that, broken down car, but not enough to propel us. Right.
Right.
So what do you think about, because black women, you know, like we've been talking about, we're one of the most highly educated right now and everything like that. So when it comes to us being entrepreneurs to be able to generate our own forms of wealth and create businesses or create economy, we're seeing that a lot of black women, or for whatever reason, we're not able to get in touch with the angel investors, or not getting the venture capitalists, getting them to invest in us. Why do we think that is?
Well, I think that there certainly is an issue in our ability to kind of, for example, like get loans to take out
right.
to start businesses,
mm-hmm.
and our interaction with traditional financial institutions. There's no doubt about it that we suffer discrimination in that market,
mm-hmm.
and that it becomes really difficult for people to get those kind of conventional loans. And so what do people do? A lot of people do when they're, like, for example, starting a business, they use credit cards to
right.
finance that business,
right.
you know, and that uptake of that business, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're doing it without having a lot of collateral assets, you know, and that's one reason why they can't qualify for a loan. And others are really, you know, just hard to get. In fact, banks are really rarely a source of credit for black businesses.
Mm. So then how do
like
people...
6% of people use a bank loan.
So then,
so,
like, if people are building businesses,
yeah.
what are they using for that, mm-hmm. for that to do that? Is it sort of like community-based, or...?
It's credit cards. It's
credit
family
cards.
And friends and
right.
networks. You know, some of this too is who has access to venture capitalists, who has
right.
access
right.
to those that can invest in their business. You know, that's not always so easy.
Yeah. So do you think buying,
at least not for the average person?
Yeah.
Do you think buying black matters? Does it make more sense then for us to be investing into our own communities, our own schools, in order to kind of
maybe possibly a little tiny, 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 tiny bit serve as a counterforce. A tiny, tiny, tiny bit.
Well, I mean, I think always that we should be doing what we can to support black businesses. We also know that there is a huge trust gap. We, you know, that people basically don't trust black businesses, including black people themselves.
Yeah.
Will it, you know, is that important for people to be able to make it? Sure. Is it going to address really kind of the deep-seated structural inequities we're seeing? Probably not as much, right? But I think for any of us, we think that kind of overcoming that trust gap, as we call it, and that credibility gap is important for black businesses to be able to make it, for sure.
Yeah.
Whether those businesses can make it rich is another story. So, you know, we have to also look about why people, why people buy homes where they do, or why people want to start a business. And it may not be all to get rich, even though we probably all would like to, but it may be a sense of freedom. It may be a sense of, being able to be your own boss, of giving back to the community, a whole host of reasons.
Mm.
But far too often, it's difficult. We find that, like, for example, black businesses do better when they already have some wealth.
Mm.
You know, so, you know, the question is, where does that wealth come from? But that wealth enables them to have that cushion, and they can actually generate more revenue than those that don't start off with as much wealth.
That is a catch 22.
Yeah,
that
that's
was
like
saying,
a catch
right?
22.
Yeah.
So do you think, like, thinking about trust and thinking about new ways to educate people or get people to trust black people, do you think that the media is maybe the place where that needs to be amplified a bit better, or like how do you see that influence?
Particularly, I think about the role of media in sort of, I don't know, in the way that it sells us all the goodies of wealth, right?
Right.
Like, you know, like if you're wealthy, you can get all of these yummy things. Right.
I mean, because the way that black people are, wealthy black people are so-called portrayed in the media today is like what I usually call like the ratchivity. Like we do have the upper echelon of like.
The ratchivity!
Yeah. Usually, you know, we have like the upper echelon of like the Oprahs and the people who have like really worked their way, I'm using air quotes, nobly to get into their wealth. But then you have like the ratchivity players who are like, you know, more of like the reality show kind of folks, but they're living like a glamorous type lifestyle,
right,
which appears to be like wealthy, but it comes with like a certain air, or you know what I mean?
And I don't know how wealthy they actually are.
Well, that's right? What I mean. Like, it's kind of like a thing.
That's a thing.
Yeah.
But it's
are
a thing.
Are they wealthy?
Yeah.
I mean, is it what we see are the material gains of what we equate with wealth?
Right.
But when you think about really wealthy people, it's not necessarily the car they drive or how, you know, what they're wearing that lets you know that they have wealth. It's deep and it's hidden,
right,
and it goes back generations.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's not something that we kind of sometimes equate with something that's very visible,
mm-hmm,
that we can see. That could be income, right? It could be like, you know, yes, if you made, you know, $1 million a year, those things might, you know, or even, you know, $500,000 a year, you can show that. But I you know, even high income blacks don't have that much wealth, right?
Right.
They, you know, people, blacks with a college degree, even blacks that make over $90,000 have about the same wealth that whites do who've dropped out of high school.
That's crazy.
They have lower income.
That's crazy.
Right? Because, you know, you got to think of certain things, right? So think about segregation. Where do black people own their homes?
Yeah.
And how much equity can they build in those homes,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly because a lot of blacks have been segregated because of housing,
mm-hmm,
you know, because of housing discrimination,
mm-hmm,
because of past segregation, right? And so where black people could own homes, they could not own homes outside of certain areas historically.
Right.
And, you know, and still are curtailed in a number of ways. To be able to be in places where equity is like, they can build that equity. You know, I think about my family in Dayton, Ohio. I mean, their homes aren't worth anything,
mm-hmm,
you know. You could get a house for $30,000, $35,000.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be a homeowner. Doesn't mean you're going to accrue that that asset in that way,
yeah.
as if you lived in San Francisco or yeah. lived in parts of Washington, D.C.
Yeah. So the thing I'm thinking about, because Eb and I were just talking a little bit earlier about how we both, in the last maybe 2 years,
yeah.
both became homeowners. So when I think about, you know, people saying like, well, home ownership is this sort of, or can be, I guess if you're white, it can be a pathway to wealth.
Right.
Would you say yes, people go out and buy homes? Not that like you can sort of give a blanket statement, but I'm asking you to.
I'm nervous.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to know the answer, but I want to know the answer.
I think it matters where you live. Local
yeah.
markets really matter,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so, like I was describing, if you're in a market area where there just really is no demand and there really is no, you know, where building equity can be very stubborn, you know, you have a home and people buy a home for all sorts of reasons too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean you can build equity in that space, right?
Right.
So if I think about, I had a cousin who lived over in San Francisco and her mother left them a home. And bought the home for $70,000, and her sister, you know, kept up that home, and they rented it out, and they decided to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
I think they sold it for well over $1 million, and you know, dollars
wow.
and plus,
wow.
because of where that home was located,
yeah. Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
because
yeah.
you know, a home in San Francisco is truly an investment where equity. You can always build that equity.
Right.
It was about place, right?
Right.
So. That really, really matters. And,
yeah.
and you know, when we yeah. think about, you know, being able to have that home and that equity so that you can help finance your kids' college.
So you got to wait for the gentrification.
You know, and do all those things, it does become an important asset.
And, I'm wondering, like, you know, how long ago they bought it, right? Because then, like, what it took for them
to
put their pennies together to pay 70 grand to get it at that moment, right? However long ago it was,
right?
That was like probably
right.
an uphill climb for them just to be able to do that.
It's like going to buy your property in Bushwick and just knowing that the gentrification is coming.
Right.
So just like wait for it.
Wait for it to displace black people. I'm
wait
not waiting for that. I'm
wait
not waiting for that.
It.
I am not waiting for that. But yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
that's the only way you would get your comeuppance.
The people are like really, the people who are able to buy in those types of places and then reap the benefits how many decades later are kind of, I mean, would you say they're outliers? That's not like the average Joe and Jane.
Because you've gone through everything in your community. You've gone through everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it took you said your homeowners, it took some wealth to get that home,
yeah.
right? A house is where we can store our wealth.
Yeah.
It can generate wealth. It's also a place that you need some wealth to get the house, and then
right.
our wealth is kind of stored there. And yes, you know, some places where there was this acceleration and now, you know, there's gentrification and then and people's homes may be worth more. May enable them to do that, but if you know, just looking here at a place where this is exploding,
yeah.
So you sell your house, where are you going to live?
Right.
You sure can't buy another house here,
right?
Right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
I mean, you have to go elsewhere, right?
Right.
You might need to go somewhere else where the cost of living is lower because you're not going to get anything by selling your house and staying here. So
it is
a matter of, you know, it's a risk. It is like there's no guarantee when you buy a home. It's like anything else that you're risking in the market, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people hedge their bets. And, you know, because of reverse redlining and that blacks were targeted particularly, I mean, which led to the foreclosure crisis, this wasn't a matter of people making bad decisions as was portrayed in the media, particularly for black people who mainly had their homes taken that they already owned.
Yeah.
I mean, these are people taking out second mortgages,
yeah.
So, you know, when we think about how housing policy is huge and how it affects people's ability to build wealth.
Yeah.
It's not some private action that's taking place. This
right.
is really a public structure
right.
where historically, you know, government policy makers and politicians decided who was going to be able to build wealth. And there was intentional policies to build wealth among the white middle class.
Right.
That's how the middle class was built. It didn't just happen.
Right.
It was constructed. It was intentional. It was strategic.
Right.
So I think the thing is that what really discourages me sometimes is to see let people get down on themselves as if something is wrong with us. And I'm not saying we still have free will and we make decisions, but some of these things are really, people just didn't get to where they were. They had bigger help
than any one generation.
You know, they
had
generations of help to get where they were. We just didn't. You know, so we just have to be cognizant of what is really about our own private decision and what is about the policies and decisions behind our choices and how our choices are maybe constrained, you know?
Yeah. I have, I feel like we have like maybe...
We have like two, maybe three questions.
four questions. Anyway, so I'm thinking about this idea of like the outliers, right? That are, we, you know, always pointed to as like the people who have attained wealth. Here I'm mostly thinking about celebrities, you know, maybe people in sort of industries where they can like, you know, acquire wealth or at least high incomes. People will point to, well, we need to do what these folk... celebrities have done, get on the path that they have been on, as you know, to follow
like
them.
That's
to,
the only track.
Yeah, that's the sort of way toward wealth, and I feel like people's shorthand for wealth sometimes is like what they. Well, I don't know if they mean it, but like I think for me, I mean like security, right? Like economic security. So, like, is that a fallacy, or is that like a reasonable assessment for people to be making if I follow the path of
an entertainer
or just somebody in industry, like in finance, whatever, then that is kind of, you know, not even a sure bet, like a better bet, you know?
Well, I think in some ways it's really a false nomer, right? I mean, it's not that it's not entirely impossible, but it's almost like the stats when you think about what, you know, how many, like, young boys can make it from high school basketball to the NBA.
Yeah, right.
It's, you know, it's not like it's not impossible. Yeah. People do it.
Yeah.
But the numbers are pretty small, right? And so I think that it's, you know, there's a matter of really, one, really understanding what it is that you really want in your life. And then how are you going to get there? And understanding that there is no easy kind of get rich quick kind of scheme. You know, some of this is a matter of, wow, I just happen to live, you know, in a part of a Philadelphia neighborhood that's changing and I can now leverage my home. You know, it is, you know, that maybe that there's certain investments that I've made. I mean, clearly having a diverse portfolio matters. It means, you know, having a home, having stocks, having like having a range of different types of assets can help you, right? Being able to do certain things, like being able to get have more of your college like education financed where you're not taking out loans, right? I mean, all of that those things make a difference. The question is, who's going to then help you do that, right? Our real struggle is that we have so few folks we can rely on to pass on wealth from one generation to the next, and that's how people generally get wealth. And even things like someone telling me, hey, I was able to live for 2 years rent-free, you know, while I was able to save all that money, and then I had $30,000 that I could go and do this. Someone didn't give you, they didn't give you $30,000 for your home, but they did give you the opportunity to save $30,000.
Yeah,
that's intergenerational wealth transfer. And so we have to also think in terms of how do we start helping seeding a generation to do this? Because quite frankly, that's the major vehicle in which people get wealth.
Yeah.
It's not the things that we think about. And fine, if you have a high income and you can, you know, you can play the stock market, you can buy a home in a certain area, you know, and have a reservoir for your kids to pass down. Hallelujah. Yeah.
Right,
you're on
the
pathway to wealth building.
That's it.
But it's a struggle for most of us to get there.
I'm glad you said that. That's like a perfect way to close out, because I know me personally, that's one of my mottos that I just took on this year, is that I hustle for my last name, not my first. Because far too often we are so focused on us. But especially at the moment that you have those children, you really should be working to build an empire, a legacy for them that they can maybe not go through the things that we had to go through. So I appreciate that. That is great in terms of intergenerational wealth building. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's our legacy. That's our ticket.
That's our legacy. Really, I like that a lot. And also to y'all other black people out there who ain't even got no kids, just stop crabbing it. Go on and help somebody out. let them get up on the couch then.
I feel like you're speaking directly to me.
Hey, you got to think about someone who worked as a domestic and gave her entire estate. Over to black kids go to college. Yeah. That is a gift. That is a legacy, right?
That is.
So, think about our legacies. You don't need kids to help in the next generation.
That's not right. I like that. Thank you, Anne. Okay, so we're going to ask some of our...
I love that.
We're going to ask our two closeout questions that are related to being unapologetic. Thank you. And then we're going to give you a chance to share with the listeners exactly how they can get in touch with you, any projects you're working on right now that you want to share. So... what does unapologetic black wealth accumulation look like? I can handle that one.
I mean, I think part of this is, and this is where even I, struggle to get people on board with me here. Mm. I think that it really is about speaking out and understanding how anti-blackness is a vehicle which has curtailed our ability to build wealth.
Yeah.
Right. Mm. So... It is steeped in this anti-blackness and kind of white advantage.
Right.
And I think that, even speaking to that is a form of resistance. Yeah. I have been told you can't speak about black people in that way. It's underlying the core of where we are. Why we are where we are.
Yeah.
So understanding really how wealth is generated, understanding how racism plays a part, and speaking up to it, about it, and getting involved is a way to be unapologetically black.
Yes. We love it. And this is like totally a divergent, but like, what did people say about you? Who told you can't speak about black people? What way? Why did they say that? In what way exactly?
There is a sense that speaking to anti-blackness is a threat.
Mm.
And it's a threat in the world that I work in. And even speaking to it can marginalize you in your work.
So it's
not easy to speak to this work sometimes because people aren't really ready to hear it. It's easy to say, can someone just open a bank account and can they just, put some money in that savings
than talking about
how Jim Crow, slavery, how the mass incarceration is keeping blacks from being able to reach their goals. That's harder to talk about than just saying, hey, can't we just give someone a bank account?
That's why.
It's threatening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're uplifting you in your work.
Yes.
Thank you for doing it. It's amazing. Yeah. And we are really excited about it. Thank you for being here.
Yep. Tell the people where they can find you.
Tell the people where they can find you and what you're doing and how you're awesome.
Well, you can find me at the Insight Center for Community Economic Development. You can follow me on Twitter and on Facebook. We have a Facebook page where you can learn more about how wealth is generated and what's happening with black families and their ability to build wealth. So find me there.
Awesome.
And I just want to thank you all. You're awesome.
Oh,
you're incredible.
Yeah.
And I love your show.
Thank you. Keep on doing
what you're doing.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. And shout out to Derek Hamilton for connecting us. You're awesome. Appreciate you.
Yes.
And you're amazing. Derek Hamilton. Thank you so much for having me on the show today. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you all. Best wishes.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. This has been another joyous episode
of Unapologetic. A black love manifesto.
We love ya.
We love ya.
We out.
Peace.
You've been listening to Unapologetic, a black love manifesto with your hosts, Eb and Jay. To keep up with the Shameless Duo, all their rants, insights, and unabashed guest interviews, please be sure to subscribe on SoundCloud or iTunes. And as always, they really love to hear from you. So please be sure to hit them up at ublm.weebly.com to share your questions, comments, or feedback. You can also follow them on FB, Twitter, and IG at UnapologeticBLM. Until next time, live life bold, free, and unapologetically. Peace. This has been a Black Lady production.